Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, award-winning Chicago novelist Rebecca Mackay is back in town after what can only be described as a whirlwind couple years. This is because her amazing book, The Great Believers, was a finalist for the Pulitzer, the National Book Award, winner of the Stonewall Award, was included in the New York Times 10 Best Books of 2018. And after all that, The Great Believers has been optioned in Hollywood. Deadline reported it's going to be turned into a TV series produced by Amy Poehler. The book was just released on paperback. Mackay is no stranger to Chicago book lovers. She's the author of The Borrower, The 100-Year House, and the collection of short stories, Music for Wartime, which was the last time Rebecca was in studio with us. Chicago writer Rebecca Mackay, my guest tonight in Extension 720. Rebecca, good to see you.
Good to see you.
A whirlwind may not be the right word. This has been for you, and we've known each other for a little while, but what an amazing accomplishment for the accolades for this great book.
It's been pretty wild. You kind of get used to the boiling water after a while, right? And in this case, boiling in the best possible way. It's not a painful or bad thing. But then I actually stop and take stock and go, Okay, a year and 3 months ago, none of these things had happened.
So did you have an inkling when you put this book out and you started to deal with the publishers and this being, you know, you're not a rookie. This is, you know, like, was just read off some of your credits, but this idea that there was something different about this book as some of the others?
Yeah, you know a lot about how a book, you know, theoretically about how a book will do long before it actually comes out. And it has to do with the reaction from the publisher, the reaction from early readers, even things like sales reps from your publisher to the bookstore, people that you don't normally think about unless you're in this business. Are they excited? Stuff like that. As I was writing it, I felt like it was different. I felt like this is the book. But I felt like that about all my books.
Right.
Every writer has to feel like that about all their books. Yeah, you're never like, well, this one's kind of half-assed, but like,
exactly.
We'll put it out there and see
what's the point otherwise, right?
Right. No, yeah, exactly. You have to believe in the current book. And so, you know, I believed in it in that way, but it wasn't until, you know, the few months leading up to publication, you start to see just a different way that it's spoken about, a different buzz about it. Even so, things can then go awry, you know, like your book comes out the day that some major national event happens, or whatever.
So I didn't even think about
that.
So
you still don't
know.
Yeah.
Does it change your relationship with the book and the characters that you live with it longer? Meaning, because now you went in paperback, and then there's obviously the stuff in Hollywood, but these characters are Yale and the gang. They're going to be around for a while. Does it change your relationship with it?
I think it does. I think that, you know, in contrast, you know, or much more so, really, than with my previous books, I feel like my research is ongoing just because I go and I read somewhere and people have their own stories to tell me. Or, you know, I get emails.
Right.
It's the same kind of research, the same kinds of stories I was asking to hear as I was writing the book. And I keep being the receiver of those stories. And I'm really grateful for that. And it makes just the world of my book, you know, keeps that very much alive for me. And there's also, you know, I'm still in touch with a lot of people I interviewed for my research. I feel like, you know, really have done a lot of stuff here in the city with Howard Brown, for instance, since the book's come out. And, you know, that didn't happen with, you know, my short story collection.
Right,
no one's,
right.
You know, people aren't kind of bringing me into a certain world based on that.
The great transition to talk about the book. But the one thing that is so valuable is when, and you've talked about this, I've seen this in a lot of the interviews, it's just about when you look at the documented work of the AIDS crisis and you think about all of the people who succumbed to the disease and all of the rallying around, the stories are usually about San Francisco. And they're about New York City. And once in a while, you might get an L.A. and others.
Yeah.
But Chicago kind of gets glossed over. And it had such an impact on the city and the gay community.
Yeah.
So you're writing, of course, and this is what you're writing about. It obviously is going to garner a lot of attention from the local community.
Yeah. And I've been thrilled about that. You know, these are the readers, of course, that I was the most terrified of, were people who'd lived through this intimately in Chicago. And this is why I did, you know, 4 years of research as I wrote the book. You know, if I mention a bar, I want to get the stickiness of that bar floor exactly right. Or the book's going to be ruined for someone. Yeah, I have been just doubly overwhelmed by, first of all, the people who did live through it in Chicago and saw themselves reflected in the book have told me, you know, that I got it right, which is everything you ever hope to hear, you know, as an author.
Right.
But then also the people who live perhaps even in Boys Town, perhaps even in the gay community here or, you know, outside of it, who did not know this stuff about Chicago, as I myself really didn't know going in. I was someone who, you know, I was a kid in the 80s, but I was, you know, very observant of and affected by the AIDS crisis, continued to be in the 90s. And, you know, the movies I was watching, the documentaries I was watching, the books I was reading, they weren't about Chicago. And I could not have told you very much at the outset of how Chicago's crisis and how Chicago's response to the crisis differed from other cities.
It's amazing, too, to think about more and more. Obviously, this year being the anniversary of Stonewall, there's been much more about that topic. But what I love about your book, and we talked about this last time you were in, is just about writing stories around Chicago or knowing, and like you just said, knowing the what you have to do as a writer to get it right and to make sure that the floor is sticky enough. But I felt that in, you know, just random references to Aldine Street or to, you know, to that kind of thing, as opposed to Belmont and Halsted or the Bistro, which was downtown, which is a bar that many people, even the gay community, wouldn't know it existed. It was such a short amount of time.
Yeah.
But there seems to be, you can tell through the writing how much research you put into it.
Thank you. And I really did. I mean, it was, I feel like, you know, when I write a short story, it's you do kind of the research you have to do. When you write a novel, it's like you're moving to that country for 4 or 5 years. You know, like I have to love this story enough. I have to love this milieu enough that I'm going to move there. I was reading, you know, every back issue of the Windy City Times from like 85 to 92. But I'd go on eBay and order like old Advocate magazines or whatever. And it's just, I'm reading it not for any particular information, but just to feel like I moved there.
It's almost absorbent, right?
Yeah.
To be
it. It helped a lot that I was writing about Chicago. I was writing across difference in so many different ways, many of which were terrifying. And to stay with Chicago, and a Chicago that my parents were not taking me to the gay bars in the 80s, but a Chicago, many parts of which I did know, a lot of which I do know. I can go and, you know, sit in the bar at Little Jim's, which, you know, was one of the first, you know, bar there on Halsted. And it's changed, definitely, but it's still there fundamentally.
How much do you, obviously, like you just said, you're ordering back orders of The Advocate, you're looking at Windy City Times archives, you're doing research. But how much, as a Chicagoan, can you as a writer just rely on your own experiences to say, I'm going to put this on Aldine as opposed to Halsted?
I can't rely on my own experiences, but I can tap into them. I think it would be a really big mistake to assume that because I think something's always been there, it's always been there. Or because, you know, this seemed important to me, it must have been important. I had to go into this with, you know, utter humility and not assuming that I could either empathize my way into these characters' minds from the outside or that I could just, you know, assume that, for instance, Ann Sather is where Ann Sather is now, you know, because it wasn't. I have to, you know, research every single thing. And it came down to things. I spent 2 freaking weeks trying to figure out exactly where the polar bears had been at the Lincoln Park Zoo in the winter of 1986. And I finally got it. But it was like, I don't want to do it wrong. I think I remember. I know where they are now. I can't just assume.
I have to ask, because you've just, you know, obviously you've become, we talked about this, not your first rodeo. You've done a couple of books, and this is your fourth book. But is that something that's been immersed in how you write? As you really want to get it right? Or is this because of the subject matter?
So partly it's a learning curve. I wish I'd done more research specifically on my first novel. But not that I got stuff massively wrong. Just I think it would have been enriched a lot.
More broad strokes than what you were doing here.
Yeah, and I think, you know, every novel that you begin or every short story that you begin, every movie makes a certain contract with reality. You know, so thinking filmically, like, you know, Wes Anderson's relationship to reality is different than David Simon's contract with reality, right? Or realism, at least. And my first two novels in particular, The Borrower and The 100-Year House, as you mentioned, they were both kind of more in that Wes Anderson-y range. My story collection is all over the place because it's a lot of different short stories. But in this particular case, you know, I'm writing about someone else's lived history. And I could have gone in, I could have made up a city that doesn't exist. I could have made up bars that don't exist. That did not feel like it would be the proper move in any way. That felt, you know, wildly disrespectful. And then having made that commitment to sort of granular realism, with a few areas that I kind of acknowledge in my author's note that I you know, renamed or reinvented. But for the most part, I'm going to be doing all the research I could as if it were nonfiction.
Yeah. Well, it feels nonfiction because, you know, I know Chicago enough to know the street names and the places, and being in this job, I've had conversations about the Bistro or other places to know the history of it. I'm not a Door County guy.
Yeah.
And I'm not a Paris. I don't know anything about Paris, but I got the feeling that even in the other scenes in this book, they're based in that realism as well.
Right, right. I wish I could have justified, like, a month in Paris to do this. But I have been there. I did a lot of Google Street View, walking the little blue guy around.
Yeah, instead, you committed to a month on Aldine, which is...
my residency.
The book is called The Great Believers. It's a novel by Rebecca Mackay. It's on paperback now. And you can go to her website, RebeccaMackay.com, for all the events that are coming up here where you're going to be reading. This has been quite a year. We'll take a quick break, come back, continue the conversation with Rebecca Mackay in studio. Stay with us. Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest, Rebecca Mackay, the Chicago novelist, The Great Believers, out in paperback, and finalist for the Pulitzer, National Book Award, New York Times accolades for top 10 books of 2018, optioned in Hollywood by Amy Poehler. Storybook life that you're living as a novelist, a Chicago novelist right now, and the reaction to the book. You can find out everything about Rebecca and where she's at, because she's got some speaking engagements coming up at her website, Rebecca Mackay, which is M-A-K-K-A-I. .com.
Thank you.
All right, so I don't want to get too deep, because this is a book that's been around for a while now, so we don't have to get into the plot and everything. But I wanted to ask just about, because there are really sort of three disparate stories happening that come together. And one is set in Paris, really 2015, modern day. One is set in Chicago in the 80s, in the gay community. And the other is back in Paris, kind of 1920s Paris. How do you do that as an author? Find the way to structurally move from chapter to chapter to keep us engaged, to go back and forth from each moment in time to the next?
You know, it kind of grew outward like a weird crystal. I actually started with what is the smallest of those three. I started with the 1920s Paris, thinking, oh, this woman will look back from the end of her life. That'd be the 80s. I guess I'll put her in Chicago. And you know, and it, the gravity shifted from there.
You told a great story to Mark Baser on his, at the interview show, I remember, about how that you realized you were writing the Titanic.
Yeah. No, I had this idea. This old woman was going to see this like sketch come up, and she's like, that's me. And my husband filmed me in. He's like, you know, that's actually the plot.
Great origin story.
I mean, yeah. Embarrassing origin story. But, novels do, change and evolve in really interesting directions as you go. In this case, I quickly realized it really was the story of the 1980s, of this one character, Yale, in Chicago. And then later, 100 pages in, realized, I need to bring it into what was then the present day, although 2015 now feels like ancient history. At that point, it becomes a lot of, note cards spread all over your floor.
So it is like that. So you're almost like Memento, like
supplies.
Trying to figure out.
It's all about school supplies. At a certain point, you kind of hope that you're counting right. You're like cutting note cards in half. You're getting highlighters. Then the dog walks through the room. it's that whole thing. And it does become this kind of Sudoku puzzle at a certain point. And I teach a lot of writing here in the city, and I'm always telling my students, you need to have this kind of switch between the two sides of your brain where you can think creatively and you could just keep adding and doing creative stuff all day, or you can switch into this critical mode where you can think architecturally and you can think structurally.
Not unlike a playwright.
Yeah, right, no, right. Absolutely. Playwriting, I learned a lot actually in graduate school about playwriting from theater courses that I took. And really, that structural stuff that has to go into a play, I think is really, really useful in a novel.
That's a great training for a writer to have that kind of structure. The other thing about it, too, is that the parallels that you make in the book, we won't go into giving away the plot, but there are parallels to what happens in Paris in the 20s and what happens to Chicago in the 80s and what happens to the communities. Was that intentional? Was the idea to sort of have a moral at the end of the story about how, time shifts or time repeats and what happens in the 80s could happen in the 20s.
I never want a moral at the end of my book, and I don't think I've done that, but I think I've asked questions, and that's really what I'm always trying to do, is leave someone with, a few maybe vague questions. But no, I did not know or see those parallels between sort of, what we think of as the lost generation in Paris after the war and the AIDS generation of cities like Chicago. I didn't see those until I began researching. And one of the first things I found actually was my title, The Great Believers, which is from this F. Scott Fitzgerald quote that I use as the epigraph. He's talking about before the war, that generation being so naive and so optimistic about America's role in the world. And of course, it's in the aftermath of both the war and the 1918 influenza, which, decimated that generation largely of its young, able-bodied men. That's when Gertrude Stein says to Hemingway, "You're all a lost generation." And I felt like in that moment when I found that the context for that quotation, I felt like I had my title and I had sort of a bit of a backbone to the book.
You know, as we talk about the, it's so obvious to me when I read the book and see the news about it being possibly turned into a television series. It works because the characters are so developed. When you talk about Yale, who's the main character, and the crew he runs with. Right, and whether it be Julian or even though the book and the people we don't meet, Nico and others, you get this vibe that because even at the beginning, because you're like, oh, that's a lot of characters right at the beginning when you set the book with, okay, this is gonna it's kind of starts at a funeral, and there are a lot of different names to pay attention to. But as the book moves on, those names becomes because of what we've learned from them, you're almost waiting to hear more about them. So you could see, I mean, it almost feels like this is the best way to do a TV show, to have this ability to do 400 pages on these characters, you know, before it sort of gets sort of processed into an eight episode series on Netflix, right?
That's what I hope. And this is one of the reasons that I was never terribly interested in a feature film. You know, it really is fundamentally a saga, partly just because of the nature of this epidemic. You know, one misconception that I had, you know, ages ago before writing the book, but certainly that I'd grown up with, was that you contracted HIV and you were dead in a couple of months. And of course, that's not the way it works. It's, you know, 5 years from infection to symptoms. And then, you know, even before medication could drop.
Which is why it was also extremely scary for the gay community in 1985.
Right. It's do you have time? Who knows how long you have? Do you want to know if you have been infected or not? And, you know, as I really plotted this out, what had originally been going to, in my mind, be a book that unfolded over a few months, I realized because of the nature of this disease, it needed to be something that spanned, even in the quote-unquote 1980s section, it spans 7 years from 85 to 92. So, you know, and just it needs to have a large cast of characters. It's fundamentally about a city. It's fundamentally
about a community.
Right. About groups of friends. And so, you know, that for me, that really meant this is, you know, this is a series. It's an 8 or 10 episode series where we can really, you know, dive deep in certain areas, maybe even expand in some cases what's in the book.
As a writer, when you spend 4 years researching a novel, and it comes out and it has this much success and it has a life of its own, I asked the question about whether or not, you know, there's a shelf life for these characters. Do you find yourself wanting to tell more stories from the research that you've already kind of started?
Yeah. I think that every time I hear more, someone shares a detail with me, or I follow this wonderful Instagram account, the AIDS Memorial account, right? That if people haven't discovered it, they should go look for it right away. And it's people writing in, you know, stories of lost loved ones. And there are just details. It's not someone's life. It's some detail that you go, I could have put something like that in. I could have used that. You know, not that my book needs to be longer.
Could you see yourself as a novelist? Because you've had a lot of different styles and stories that you've told over your career. Could you see yourself revisiting or doing more on this topic?
I don't think so. Yeah. I think that what I am planning to do, I think that there are nonfiction pieces for me to write. For instance, you know, this coming spring will be the 20th anniversary of that National ACT UP demonstration in Chicago that I wrote about.
Right.
A lot of the people who were there are people I interviewed for the book, the survivors I could find. I think that's a long form nonfiction piece for me that I'm excited to work on, you know. And I think that as I work on this series, you know, and I'm going to stay involved artistically to some extent, which remains to be seen. But, you know, facilitating the connections between the creative people and the resources that I found here in Chicago, you know, adding to these worlds, I'm really excited about that. In terms of I'm someone who needs wildly different projects every time. I need something really, really different.
Rebecca Mackay, we look forward to seeing The Great Believers on the television screen. We also look forward to nonfiction pieces and, of course, what you do next. Chicago novelist, the book The Great Believers is out on paperback. You can find all the information about Rebecca is reading and speaking at her website, RebeccaMackay.com. It's M-A-K-K-A-I. Rebecca, great to see you.
Thank you.
And thanks
too.
For being here.